Thanks very much, and thanks very much to the organizers as well for inviting me here. Well, I'll not only talk about cell motility, but continue a bit in the first part on what we just heard about phase separation and coarsening in model membranes and in cell membranes. But now, well, I show some simulations of that. And basically would like to consider the discrepancy between, well, model membranes where one actually sees this large-scale phase separation and more or less dynamically stable microdomains in cell membranes. And then move on to describe crawling of cells by an approach which combines mechanical properties of membranes with some active components going on in the cytoskeleton. And again, model this in a more or less effective way using continuum description. And if there's some time at the end, I also tell you about some mathematical tools which can be used to solve that. Okay, so I don't need to introduce too much about the subject here. So this is also work from Sarah. We have in this giant unilamellar vesicles, we see, well, phase separation, and I should mention that I'm here only considering the case where I'm below the critical point. And we have these two phases, and I distinguish them between liquid ordered and liquid disordered phase. Well, and one sees, well, ripening or spinodal decomposition, well, in the same way we saw this just in the last talk. And well, the simplest way to describe this theoretically is to, well, use a two-phase system with the driving force just being the line tension between the two phases. And then this can be described, if you forget anything else, just by model B or a Cahn-Hilliard equation. The only difference now is that, well, it happens on a surface. And but this can also be done. So we have this Ginzburg-Landau type energy with this double well and the gradient term. It's now just the surface gradient, and we have the line tension parameter, and we look at conserved dynamics of that. And well, indeed, depending now on the composition, we see, well, ripening or spinodal decomposition, and this coarsens nicely to some macroscopic phase. I just saved some computing time and not showing the evolution towards the final state. Okay. So we also looked at like the critical questions here, like what is the scaling exponent, is there self-similarity, and so on. And indeed, we find this, and we also did some computations on where we varied the diameter of our domain, and we didn't see any effect of that. So we can also do this these studies, well, in, well, just in 2D, and it's not very surprising what one gets. It's, one gets a one-third scaling of the domain size, or minus one-third scaling of the interface length. And one gets a size distribution function, which is self-similar. And according with the classical LSW theory, well, one gets some broadening of this size distribution function if the well, the coverage increases. So this is very much known, and it's also consistent with the 2D Ising model. As we heard already in the talk from Sarah, this is only half of the story. So there are other effects which play a role already if one studies vesicles. And it becomes even more more complicated if one goes to, well, real cell membranes. So there's a big discrepancy between this, well, in vitro and in vivo results. While in cell membranes, one doesn't really observe such a macroscopic coarsening, but instead one sees some heterogeneity of some micrometer length scales which persist over the whole time. And okay, now one can maybe explain this by, well, what is termed lipid rafts, if they exist or not. I don't want to go into that business, but But anyway, today they are basically understood as simply being, well, a heterogeneity which result from interactions of lipids with proteins which are on the membrane, interactions with the cytoskeleton, well, with fluid, and also with effects due to local curvature changes. Or there might be even more effects which lead to this heterogeneity. And it's a huge field, and there are many theoretical concepts been proposed to describe this. And well, we again could view this as a two-phase system, where we now have one phase, which we might term the lipid raft phase. It's some phase which is enriched in cholesterol, proteins, and saturated lipids, and there's a matrix phase. And this is our two-phase system. And now the question is why we don't observe the same coarsening as we see in this vesicles. There are various reasons for that, and there's a nice review paper by Miku Hataya kind of critically looking at these different theories. So one explanation might be that one just sees some equilibrium fluctuations here, or the reason might be that they are immobile surfactant proteins which kind of pin the domains, or there are aggregations of protein rafts, or even interactions we see with the cytoplasm, and many more. So I would picked out four of them, and the first thing was above the critical point, one just says that they are trends in compositional fluctuations which are driven by thermal noise. So that's maybe the easiest explanation of the whole thing. Another thing which might be a theory is to say that between the two phases we have like this saturated and unsaturated lipids. There is some hybrid lipid, like where we have one saturated chain and one unsaturated chain. I have to look it up. So that was POPC, what Marcus termed this, right? So and now one can postulate that this kind of acts like a line active component, like a surfactant you have, and might reduce the line tension. However, that would basically then slow down the coarsening or even prevent the system from coarsening. However, there's no experimental evidence that this is really, really the case. But that's just another theory. Then we heard in Sarah's talk that membrane viscosity and interaction with the bulk fluid might also prevent the system from coarsening. And so there are also theoretical studies here, and we heard of another one here at UCSB. So I will talk a bit on that. And another theory is to say that due to the presence of proteins on the membrane, which might be energetically favorable to in one of the two phases, one has some pinning effects, which also might change the scaling behavior. And the same effect can also be due to the presence of the cytoskeleton and the effect of the cytoskeleton on these different phases. Okay, let's look at this membrane viscosity problem and the bulk interaction. So now let's consider the whole system. So we have two fluids, the fluid in the cytoplasma and the fluid in the extracellular matrix. And in between we have our membrane as a boundary between the two fluids. And now the question is, what kind of boundary conditions do we have to specify along the membrane for the bulk fluid? And as the whole thing evolves, so that's quite a complicated thing here, and it's something which is nicely related to work in chemical engineering to describe emulsions. We have one model surfactants, and it's called the so-called Business-Griven law. And this boundary condition was often written down, but nowhere really solved in the general setting. So I also don't want to really do this. So we basically have a Navier-Stokes equation on the membrane, which couples to the bulk, and due to the fact that everything is evolving, that becomes a quite complicated thing. Well, in the experimental study from Sarah, and also in the two existing computational studies, the situation was a bit simplified in the sense that the membrane was assumed to be flat and not evolving. I will attack the problem from a bit different perspective, and looking first at this, well, hydrodynamic length Sarah just also introduced. It relates the viscosity of our membrane to the viscosity in the bulk and defines a length scale, also termed the Stefan-Delbrück number. And well, typically the viscosity in the membrane is larger than the viscosity in the bulk phase. And well, now I'm a mathematician, so I can go to some limit and assume that this number goes to infinity, which basically then says that the bulk and the surface flow decouple from each other. And so that means that I can just study the flow on the surface on the membrane. And so that, however, is still a quite complicated mathematical problem, as well, the Navier-Stokes equation on a curved surface looks different than in flat space. There are some additional terms due to the Gaussian curvature. And well, numerically solving this is also challenging due to the fact that well, second order operators for vector valued quantities are kind of a tricky thing. However, one can nicely reformulate this to the fact that it's just 2D and there's no boundary involved. It's just a closed surface. So one can come up with a well, stream function formulation for the whole problem. And that requires some differential geometry. But at the end, it basically looks the same as one would also in 2D recover. So what we have then here is just our well, convective convective Kahn-Hilliard equation with this Jacobian term modeling the convective part. And then this is coupled to the stream function thing where we have this additional term due to the Gaussian curvature here. And we have a forcing term, and this is just the curl of this this line tension force one has typically in this model H. So this is now a system of equations where we can solve. It's only scalar valued quantities involved there. And well, one can do this. And we first do this on a sphere and compare the coarsening now with flow and without flow. So we already squenched the system below the critical temperature. And we see the same time frames with flow and without flow. Well, and the qualitative result here is that the flow simply enhances the coarsening. So this was not really what we wanted as a proof of the theory that well, the flow interactions might prevent the system from coarsening. However, as I said, it's only one part of the system. Well, just to demonstrate this is not only working on a sphere but on complicated surfaces. One can do this on a Stanford bunny as well. Well, it's not just funny pictures. What comes out of this, sorry for the bad quality here, is that actually the surface morphology has a strong influence on the flow. This is due to the well, Gaussian curvature, which enters into the equation. Actually, vertices travel to regions where the Gaussian curvature changes. So for evolving membranes, the flow becomes even more complicated due to this full coupling then while the geometry is changing, right? Okay, so this this was the first series. The second series was the spinning effects due to membrane proteins. We assume that such a membrane protein, well, energetically favors energetical interactions with one of the two phases. Well, it doesn't matter which one. That might also be due to some well, pinning due to filaments of the cytoskeleton. It's essentially the same effect. And to model this, well, it's the same model B. We have our Ginzburg-Landau type energy and a conserved dynamics. We just modify it here by this additional term. It's just a pinning potential where we randomly choose some positions and modify the potential there by just lowering the double well at this local position. Right, so this favors then this phase at this point for where our proteins are located. And now we can do the same studies, and we didn't do this on the surface, just in 2D, just to concentrate on this effect, and did some large-scale simulations. And what you see here is the reached stationary shape, or at least where we stopped our computations over here for increasing number of pinning sites. And what one finds is that indeed now the system kind of is not anymore allowed to coarsen to some macroscopic scale. And if one looks at the scaling here, again, we plot the interface length over time on a log scale. The scaling, there are some differences to what we saw before. So first of all, there's some crossover here, which occurs much earlier to some very, very slow coarsening or no coarsening at all. And the scaling exponent also changes. So we get basically an increasing exponent with the increasing number of pinning sites. And even more dramatically, we lose self-similarity. So we get a broadening of the size distribution function with the number of pinning sites, and there is no more self-similarity present in the evolution. And to summarize that, we get a slowing down of the coarsening with this pinning sites, we get a broadening of the size distribution, and we have no more self-similarity. So that at least gives some hint that these pinnings might be one reason for seeing this heterogeneity in cell membranes. And we are not the first ones who found this, the first simulations to do this on a continuum scale. However, if one looks instead of the 2D icing model at a 2D random field icing model, which basically corresponds to that, then this has the same properties. So there is no self-similarity, there is no scaling at all, and there is some work from the group of Petra Schwiller and Richard Wink, who independently did this using Monte Carlo simulation and basically found the same results. Okay, that was basically the stuff on coarsening. But now, as I already mentioned, the membrane by its own is something which evolves in time. And the way we model this is on a continuum scale. So there's no thickness and no structure so far. It's just a surface, and it evolves according to this Helfrich energy, where the basic driving force is the mean curvature. We have a bending rigidity, some Gaussian, spontaneous curvature, and a line tension here. And in the simplest case, one ignores inertia forces in the membrane, and the bulk fluid is assumed to be highly viscous, and then we can simply say that the velocity of my membrane evolves according to minus this variation derivative. By assuming a constant volume, one indeed, if one starts with an ellipsoidal shape, one gets this red blood cell shape. So that's all well known. But now we said that there are different phases on the membrane. We have this lipid ordered, lipid disordered phase, or in the raft phase and the matrix phase. So we termed this phi, and now my Helfrich type energy, if I consider this, should be a bit more complicated. So the material parameters should depend on phi. And if I now want to derive some thermodynamically consistent model for the evolution of the membrane, the shape of the membrane, and the phase both together, then I can do this by considering mass conservation and energy dissipation. One ends up with such a model where I basically have this well, Cahn-Hilliard type equation here on the evolving membrane, and then I have an evolution equation for the membrane with various coupling terms coming from the derivation. So one can solve this, and indeed one can use this model to see, well, budding and fission and all these phenomena which are known. So, but this is not really the topic. I would now continue and further make this model a bit more complicated to also incorporate some active components and to study them, then cell motility. So now let's think about a bit how cells move. Well, the crawling cells typically move by, well, first protruding the cell front and then retracting the cell rear. So this this are two driven phenomena which are done by, well, reorganization of the actin cytoskeleton. And so basically we have some actin polymerization to push the cell front, and then some complicated reaction between the actin and then myosin, which leads to this retraction of the cell rear. This is all described through some protein interactions. There are quite complicated signaling networks here going on. Again, I just want to model this in a continuum way, in some effective way. So what I need is some concentration of proteins which are in the cytoplasma, so they are allowed to diffuse there, they are allowed to attach and detach from the membrane, and then I have proteins which are attached to the membrane. And then I would like to couple the concentration of these membranes to the evolution of the membrane. So what I basically need is something which distinguishes between the cell front and the cell rear. So I need some polarity for the cell to know in which direction to go. And well, one way to get this is through some more instability, a Turing type instability. And the model I look at is a reaction diffusion type model, but in a coupled way, accounting for proteins or concentration of proteins on the cell membrane. So these are this lowercase u thing. So we have just a diffusion equation with some reaction terms, and it's defined on this evolving membrane. And then we have some source term here. This is just the attachment detachment coming from the bulk, from the cytoplasm. And then in the cytoplasm, we have a diffusion reaction equation for, well, the concentration of proteins present there. So this this uppercase use, again with some reaction terms I do not really specify. And then I have boundary conditions which are just modeling, well, the flux here at the membrane just being defined as this well, this source term here, and I use some Langmuir law to describe that. So in the simplest model, well, this lowercase u are just well, active and inactive states of some GTPases, and the coupled u are just some complexes of the cytoplasmic GTPases. And now the nice thing about this coupling between these different dimensions, more 3D in the cytoplasm and 2D on the membrane, is that there are more sources for Turing-type instability. So usually Turing-type instability one knows of requires different diffusion coefficients between two interacting species. However, now it's also possible to get this instability by having different diffusion in the cytoplasm and on the membrane, or even by having different attachment and detachment coefficients in this coupling terms between the cytoplasm and the membrane. So there are way more ways to get this instability, and that might also be biologically more relevant than having just different diffusion coefficients on the membrane. So now how to incorporate this in my model? So the simplest model I had for the evolution of my membrane was this one, was just this L2 gradient flow of the Helfrich energy. And now I simply add this additional components. Well, alpha being some kinetic coefficients, and then I have U, this was the concentration of this membrane bound proteins, like this active GTPases, for example. And then depending on the size, the sign of alpha, I get the force in one direction or the other. And I can also couple this to the concentrations of this GTPase complex in the cytoplasm and just take the value at the membrane. This has been, for example, done in this this work by Levine in San Diego, and but one can do this more general, and due to this coupling between cytoplasm and membrane, one gets way more freedom. And I'll just show you some results for that. It's only 2D. The first thing, we start with a circular shape, and then show the concentration on the membrane. So that is the activated GTPases, and that's the inactivated, and here we see the concentration in the cytoplasm. So there's some instability forming, just leading to this this polarity. So we have one maxima on one side, and the other phase has a maxima on the other side. And indeed, then we have an evolution or a movement of our membrane in that direction. And at some point, we form a stationary state and a constant velocity. So that that works, and we get also different. Different forms of cell movement, like rod-like protrusions, where we here simply change the reaction parameters to get then three maxima, for example, and get this other deformations of the membrane. Now, one way to make this a bit more realistic is to say that the cell should move in a direction to which is driven by some spatial signals. So we can incorporate some chemoattractant here. So that was the equation for our concentration of this membrane bound protein, and we simply add such a chemoattractant term here, which gives an evolution in the direction where we have a gradient of some bulk phase C, some chemoattractant. And just to demonstrate this, we just use a rotating field for C here in the extracellular matrix, and then indeed, my cell really rotates and follows this gradient. So this can also be done. And at the end, let's say something about how we solve this numerically. So what we basically have is we have to solve equations on evolving surfaces, we have to solve equations in evolving domains, and we have to solve equations which describes the evolution of the surface. And one way of doing this is to rewrite everything into simply equations in a standard stationary domain. And one can do this by having the surface PDE, for example, basically multiplying each term with the surface delta function and then smearing this out appropriately. And we have this phase field type description phi, and the gradient of phi is just an approximation of a surface delta function. So putting this all everywhere in, we end up with an equation on just a stationary domain. And we can do the same for these equations in these evolving bulk phases, just then having phi as the order parameter distinguishing between in and out. And now we can easily couple them together. And indeed, one can now show that with appropriate choice for phi, we can couple this to an equation for phi as well to describe the evolution. one can prove asymptotically that well, if this diffuse interface within this fiber will goes to zero, one really ends up with the original equation and can do some error analysis and so on for that. And with this, I'm basically at the end, just to mention the people involved, so people in my group, and we further collaborate with biomathematics group in Dortmund, and in Irvine with John Loven group, and in Illinois with Shuang Li, and well, some work was done by Knut Erik Teigen in Trondheim. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Questions?
I noticed you left out the Gaussian curvature term in the Helfrich-Hamiltonian. You don't have changing topologies, I think, but you do have domain boundaries where you get the contribution from that term. Is there a reason for doing that?
Okay. They are left out here in the first studies due to the fact that, well, I don't have any topological change, so it will not won't matter. However, you're right that there are additional effects if the material parameter changes between the different phases, then you can't use this Bonnet theorem, and well, this term will have an effect, but it's not considered here. Yeah. But yeah, one can incorporate this by using a phase field type description for the whole model, and yeah, one can incorporate a Gaussian curvature or approximate a Gaussian curvature also through this phase field type modeling. But it's simply not done in this simulation.
Yeah, and the magnitude is proportional to the difference in Gaussian rigidity. So if that's small, then it's
yeah,
pretty good.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Thanks.
Other questions? Glenn?
The systems that crystallize on a spherical manifold, there are these restrictions by topology on, you know, like you have to have a certain difference between fivefold and sevenfold disclinations. In these types of pattern forming systems where you've got much more disordered kinds of patterns, I mean, are there implications because of the constraint to lie on the sphere of kind of statistical characteristics of them, you know, the local restriction, you know, constraints on kind of the overall environment of features.
I don't think that for this system here, just having this model B on a curved surface, there is really a restriction due to the fact that the driving force is just the line tension, and so the line tension is not in any case affected by the topology, and well, the model just wants to reduce the line tension, and then well, that's it. So it's and it's conserved, so that it's not affected by the topology. But surely for more complicated free energies, one has this. If one has some stripe phase or whatever, then one induces defects or this ordering you just mentioned. So this. But this is a whole different field, and I don't think that for this model here, it plays a role.
One question: when you're looking at the evolution of this surface, you go to the limit where the surface is far more viscous than the outside fluid. In the flat interface case, that would be a singular perturbation. Where the outside fluid is always going to be relevant, even if that term is small. In your case, presumably, it's either the Reynolds number or the curvature that's regularizing that. Could you comment a little on that?
So you're referring to that approximation here at the beginning. Well, I say that well, this LH goes to infinity, right? Well, I don't know exactly if there's some regularizing effect due to the curvature or something. I don't think so. I actually saw that even in the for the flat case that leads to a decoupling of the the bulk and the surface fluid.
Well, what's the sort of range of Reynolds numbers in your simulation then? And you're solving the whole Navier-Stokes equation, right?
No, I'm not solving anything in the bulk.
But for the surface.
Yeah.
You include the inertia terms.
Right. Yeah. I only solve the Navier-Stokes equation on the surface, but don't couple it to the bulk. Yeah.
So the assumption is basically that your object is smaller than the hydrodynamic length.
I don't know if this is really the assumption. Right, yeah, okay.
If it's finite, yeah. But the object's still smaller, it would still work. As long as the object's smaller hydrodynamic length, it does have to
be. Yeah, of course, yeah. So, yeah, my hydrodynamic length is infinite, that's true.
Back to your cell model that you have, and you're trying to represent the cell motility, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
So sometimes people in biology, they argue about the role of the microtubules. I was wondering if you have some ideas about that.
No, I mean, that's what I presented is the simplest thing as an effective model you could think of, right? Of course, you can refine this and incorporate all that, for example, your microtubules, but it's not in this model, and it's probably hard to incorporate this in such a continuum model.
Would you be able to validate this model with data without the use of microtubules, perhaps?
Well, I can only validate it by looking at movement of cells and then combine it. But it's far off from being validated by having realistic parameters. So all this basically where we are. These alphas and betas here, they don't have really a biological interpretation, are just effective parameters to describe this effect.
Yeah. Other questions?
So I noticed that in your equations of motion, the Euler-Lagrange derivative of the Helfrich-Hamiltonian axis, the source of a normal force on the interface, but there are also tangential stresses in membranes, which are sort of quadratic expressions of the curvatures, and I would think those might matter for the flow in the membrane, but I don't see how they enter your flow equations.
No, they are actually not. This is the full thing with the normal and tangential component. I'm considering those.
This thing is purely normal. dE by d gamma, if gamma is the shape, that's entirely normal.
Well, it's not normal anymore if you incorporate different phases.
Then you have the tangential component. What I'm saying is, even in a homogeneous membrane, and even though the Euler-Lagrange derivative is purely normal, the stresses everywhere in the membrane are not purely normal, and so those I would think might matter for the flow in the membrane. I just don't see how that would happen.
Yeah, in the flow problem, It's considered, I didn't show any flow simulations on evolving membranes, which I combined with an evolution for the Helfrich model. I didn't talk about that. So only the flow simulations I showed are just for stationary shapes, right? Well, the boundary conditions you need to specify then are this Business-Griffin type models, which you need to in addition, incorporate these derivatives from the Helfrich model. They are not in there, so one can write this down, but I don't think that anybody has solved that.
Other questions? I have a question for your crawling cells. Can you explain how you transfer momentum? Because you describe motion in the membrane and inside the cell.
Yeah.
And how does it do you produce overall displacement without transferring the momentum either to a substrate or to the surrounding? If it's swimming or if it's crawling, there has to be a substrate somewhere. So how do you describe motion without momentum transfer?
Okay, I assume that this is on these are cells on a substrate and I have some friction
but
term.
But isn't the friction and coupling momentum with the substrate is the key for transport?
Yeah.
So where is it in your description?
Well, basically in this. Basically in this K term here.
But what is the flat substrate?
Yeah, it's a flat substrate so far, right? And I have my two-dimensional cell on it, and this describes the evolution and the.
Okay.
I have a force coming from the from the elastic properties of my membrane. I have a force coming from these active components, related to the concentration of the proteins.
So it's like a Lampaudia type of.
Excuse me?
Do you have like a solid, like typically the way I think it's modeled is you have a solid like object inside, like a connected cytoskeleton, like a Lampaudia pull out, you put focal conic in, and you pull it, so it's done mostly through this solid or like response rather than liquid response. So it's a very different type of motion.
Yeah, I just modeled this, everything which goes on in the cytoskeleton in some effective way. I say, well, if the concentration of this protein which drives the polymerization leading to the protrusion is some value, then this gives some driving force in normal direction. So this is very effective way of describing that.
So it's liquid light stresses rather than solid light stresses. Other questions? I have one more question. It was the first part. When you put in your quench randomness with the tagged proteins, are you doing some kind of finite size? There are basically two phenomena. One for coarsening is the barrier to go from one region where you have some concentration of those tags to another region where you have, say, higher concentration, but it will be you have to go through a low concentration region to coarsen. Mm-hmm. And eventually, in a random system, they're always going to be far enough, another region would have even better density. But to get there will take a very long time. So are you looking at this finite size scaling of how things will go in large systems?
We try to the simulations are relatively large, we try to distinguish regions where we have a denser packing of pinning sites and other regions and see differences in the domain size of our domain then. But the data were not good enough to get a distinction here.
Yeah. I'm talking about you simulate a smaller system and a larger system and see how times and the numbers, the size of domain scale with the system size. That's what's called finite size scaling. to see whether your results are dependent on choosing
on
a particular box size.
Okay. Well, we just chose the largest size we were able to simulate with the high performance computer we had available and used that.
Thank you. Other questions? Go ahead.
Besides, how do finite size effects work on a sphere? I mean, a finite correlation length suffices to couple everything to everything else.
Yeah.
Is it worse or is it better than on a plane?
Well, I don't know. I have to find out. I don't know.
No. Neither do I.
Yeah.
Okay, any more questions? If not, let's thank the speaker one more time. Okay, the last presentation this morning is by John Amashia.